children. With that, we welcome to the city, Rabbi Sidowitz.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Wow, that's some introduction. Usually you have to wait to be horizontal to hear something like that, but I thank you very much. Actually, it must be old, because I'm happy to say I still have the one wife and the four children, but I'm up to 12 grandchildren now.
Oh, my God!
So it has to be amended, but anyway, thank you very much. And I thank you all for coming as well. It's really a pleasure for me to be here in a beautiful Poughkeepsie, and I looked on the website today to get the directions, and I didn't realize the shul was founded 1888. It's really something to have that type of continuity in a Jewish community. And by comparison, our shul in Teaneck just started in 1958. It's like a child compared to the shul. But to see the community still in existence and still thriving, and all under the leadership of your wonderful Mora Dasser, as you said, I've been in contact with a number of months already, a Talmud Chacham with such exuberance for Torah and for the Jewish people, it is indeed a pleasure to be here. I should say, you know, it's not the first time I'm here. When I was a teenager, I worked 2 summers in Hyde Park. I used to come this way all the time, and of course, I've been to the FDR Library a number of times as well. But to be in the heart of Jewish Poughkeepsie, it's really a pleasure, and I thank you all for coming out. You know, that announcement about Vassar was very interesting, because the BDS movement is one thing that we'll have to contend with in the future as well. I was on Capitol Hill the other day, on Wednesday, with NORPAC, the Political Action Committee, going to various offices, and it turns out one of the issues we discussed was just this, and there's going to be a bill that will be presented to Congress in the next few months that will deprive any university who supports the BDS movement of federal funds. So when the bill is introduced, please be aware of it and call whoever congressman is here that he should support it as well. And I think that will tap down some of that criticism over time. But you should know, as we discuss the future of Israel tonight, that's an issue. It's an issue that has to be dealt with. But in the grand scheme of things, I think it represents almost the last gasp of those who are bitterly and acrimoniously anti-Israel, anti-Zionism, and will be able to put them in their proper place. Let me start by saying that the topic, the future of Israel, is quite a daunting one. You know, Chazal say, our sages say, in the tractate Baba Basra, Omer Rabbi Yochanan said, Miyom Shecharav Beis HaMikdash, from the day the Holy Temple was destroyed, Nitlo Nevuah Min HaNeviim, V'nitna L'shotim U'letinokos. Prophecy was taken away from the prophets, and it was given over to fools and to children. Well, I'm not a child anymore, not with 12 grandchildren. I hope that I'm not a fool. You'll be the judge of that by the end of the evening. But I think what it means, prophecy, the ability to see the future, was given to fools because they see out of the box. And it was given to children because children have no agenda. They're very innocent, almost simple in their views. They'll analyze reality and they'll say, this is what it is and this is what will happen. We can't predict the future, but what we can do is look at the past and especially look at the present, and from that be able to have at least an indication of what the future is. We're able to look at trends, and to be an analyzer of trends is a significant element of wisdom. In fact, the sages tell us, Eizeu Chacham, who is wise? Haroa es hanolad. Someone who could see something that will be developing in the future. Nolad, already in existence, but not yet visible, not yet apparent. But if we can anticipate it, that's the Chacham. We could see the trends that are developing now, and then be able to anticipate what will happen in the future. So we have to look to the past first, and the past in which the milieu, the social circumstance, the historical circumstance in which Israel arose, so no doubt was a most troubled one. We don't have to recall it. I mean, some of us here lived through it, lived through a world that did not have a state of Israel, lived through a world, unfortunately, where Jews paid a very steep price in terms of over 6 million killed. So that's the past. it was brought home to me in a very real way by a document that I received, maybe Rabbi Kaplan did as well, from a colleague of ours, Rabbi Tradberg's in Israel. How we found them, I don't know, but he sent out last week a resolution from 1943. Remember the year, 1943 was 2 years before World War II ended, before the Holocaust came to an end, and 5 years before the State of Israel was established. 1943 resolution of the Alabama State Legislature. And it turns out, who would have thought that the Alabama State Legislature became the first state in the country to call for the establishment of a Jewish state? 1943. And they noted, whereas the policy of the Axis powers to exterminate the Jews of Europe through mass murder cries out for action by the United Nations, representing the civilized world, emphasizes the urgent need for a Jewish homeland and the oath of the Balfour Declaration and the League of Nations, etc., therefore resolved by the Senate and House of Representatives of the State of Alabama that the establishment of a Jewish homeland in Palestine and facilities for its further development, receiving the maximum number of Jewish refugees, it's not only an act of justice to the Jewish people and the righting of an ancient wrong, but as an integral part of the new democratic world order, in which every people shall have the right to self-government and self-determination. Wow, the state of Alabama. Didn't come from New York, didn't come from New Jersey. Came from Montgomery, where I don't know there's a large Jewish community. But in the name of justice, in the name of defense of Jewish rights, they stepped forward. And something else as well that really brought a smile of joy to my lips. I never heard of it before, never saw it before, but it was a proclamation issued by the Jewish community of Tripolitania. Tripolitania is the westernmost province in Libya. It's where Tripoli, the capital, is located. And it dates from, Tavshintet, the 5th of Iyar, tonight, in the year 5709, which of course is 65 years ago, the first anniversary of the Declaration of Independence of Israel. And it says, I'll just read it briefly in translation, brothers and sisters in all the holy communities of Tripolitania, according to the authority of the government of Israel and the chief rabbis, declaring this day, the 5th of Iyar, the day of Israel's independence, as a holiday and festival in every year in Israel, wherever Jews are across the world, therefore they embrace it, they declare this the holiday with these provisions. The week of Yom HaTzmut, the week of Israel Independence Day, Kol Ben HaNolad, any child born in Tripolitania this week, if he's a boy, he has to have the name Yisrael, Israel. And if she's a girl, Habat Tikare Tziona. She'll be called Tziona. Interesting approach. Wouldn't fly today, of course. But nonetheless, you see the great passion that they had for the reborn Jewish state. And they said, this day will be celebrated, Yom Ha'ed V'Chag, a festival. We'll recite Hallel. We'll have parties. We'll give gifts to each other. Just like we do on Purim, we'll have a special meal with meat and wine, and we'll sing songs and Tehillim. All places of business will be closed on this day. That's how they understood it. Unfortunately, as we know, that community was not long in its existence. Many had to flee already in 1949. There was a pogrom there in 1967 after the Six-Day War, at which point the rest of the community fled as well. And I think over the years, just a small handful of Jews remained. I don't know if there are any left anymore today. So that's the past. You know, Jews have a tendency to always be pessimistic and to see the world as collapsing and to always assume that whatever is bad is going to happen, that is the norm. But now, 66 years after the Declaration of Independence, after the State of Israel, so we have to look back first and say, Hodu Hashem Ki Tov, Ki Le'olam Chasdo. Give thanks to God, because He is good, His kindness is everlasting. Who would have thought, look, some here I assume are older than I am, who would have thought going back into the 20s and 30s and 40s that we'd be in this situation today. Whatever problems exist, they pale before the blessings and the opportunities that we've been given. And this was brought home to me so vividly in a story that I shared with my congregation over Pesach, that I just read over Pesach in a new Haggadah that I bought, the Haggadah of Rav Rimon in Israel. And he tells such a moving story about someone he knew, a person I knew the name, but I never knew anything about him except he was an editor of a journal that I read, Rabbi Yonah Emanuel. Rabbi Yonah Emanuel edited Hamayan. He was a longtime teacher of Torah, died over a decade ago. In 1985, at the bris of a grandson in Jerusalem, he told the following story. And he said at the time, he never told this story to anyone, not to his wife, not to his children, but he feels incumbent upon himself to tell the story at that occasion. And he said it was 40 years earlier, 1945, late March, and he was in Bergen-Belsen, concentration camp in Germany. And it was a brutal scene. He was forced to labor, arduous labor every day, was there for a number of months. He would come back exhausted every night after the day of work, broken already by 2 years of maltreatment. He was 19 years old at the time. He said by that time his father was dead, two brothers were dead, a sister, younger sister was dead, all killed by the Nazis. His mother was barely clinging to life in her barracks in Bergen-Belsen. And we know right before, right after liberation, Jews were dying by the hundreds every day of typhus and other diseases and malnutrition. He said that night, the night of the story, was the night of Pesach. And things were already in upheaval because the Allies were approaching, the British were approaching, they were just a week or two away, and the Nazis were trying to negotiate their way out. So the camp was in a little upheaval. And he got to spend the night, Pesach night, at his mother's bedside. And she's barely conscious. And at his mother's bedside, he recited the Haggadah, what he remembered by heart. And I said, he had no wine, and he had no matzah. All they had in abundance was maror, the bitter herb. They didn't even have the vegetable. All they had was the bitterness. And he read the whole Haggadah as much as he remembered by heart. And then he came to the last blessing, right at the end of Magid, right before we eat the matzah, Asher ge'alonu v'goalas avoseinu mitzrayim, thanking God who redeemed us, redeemed our fathers from Egypt. And then the blessing has a phrase, Kein Hashem Elokeinu, so to God, yagi'enu l'moadim v'lirgalim acherim, God, you should bring us to other festivals, to other holidays, smechim b'vinyan irecha, v'sasim avodasecha, rejoicing in the rebuilding of your city, Jerusalem, and glad to be in your service. And as he came to those words, and he was about to say them, he stopped. And he couldn't say them, could not articulate the words. And he said, for the first time throughout the whole ordeal, as much as he tried to cling to life and everything that Jewish life has to offer, he could not say the words. And he said, what are we saying? God should bring us to other holidays, other festivals. Is there anyone here who's going to see another festival? Is there anyone here who's going to live to see Yerushalayim, Jerusalem, rebuilt? Is there anyone here who can ever again expect to be happy? And he said at that point, he stopped. His mother was not conscious already, and he didn't say the rest of the Haggadah. He stopped in the middle of the bracha, and he said, I can't finish it. Couldn't say the words. For the first time, he didn't believe what he was saying. And then he continued, and he said, now it's 40 years later. that night, if I could have imagined that I would be able to see the land of Israel with one sister and two brothers who survived with them, if I had been able even just to imagine that eventually I'd be able to live in a Jewish state, if only that night I could have imagined that I'd be able to have children, wife, children, and grandchildren, and celebrate the bris of my grandson in Yerushalayim, if I could only have imagined that, I would have been able to finish the bracha. But that night, I could not imagine that. But tonight I finished the bracha. And tonight I thank God for all that He's given us, all that He's brought to us. My friends, that was the past. That was the past that we knew all too well, all too bitterly. We knew exactly what the price was. And that past is behind us, I pray. That past is something that should never recur. And that past is something we look back as maror, but then we drown out with the matzah of freedom, because it's a different world. And that different world exists in a way that if we don't realize and don't enunciate, shame on us. It's a blessed era in which we live. And I say without any hesitation, and I've studied history now for many, many decades, we are living in a golden era of Jewish life. If you look back thousands of years, certainly the 2,000 years of the exile, it's hard to find a period of time that has found Jewish life so sustained, so prosperous, so thriving, to the extent that in the exile, for example, there are very, very, very few Jews today, if any, who live in under despotic regimes, who live under dictatorships. Most Jews live in free societies, and therefore most Jews have the ability to study Torah and do the mitzvos as they wish. That's unprecedented in our history. Even what's referred to as the golden era of Spain in the 10th, 11th and 12th centuries, yeah, it was a golden era because they weren't killing us, but we had second-class status. We weren't fully embraced by the society. It was different. And that's just in the exile. In the state of Israel, Israel today has a little over 6.1 million Jews in a total population of 8 million. 10 times what it had 66 years ago. And it's the largest Jewish community in the world. It's the first time we could say that since the eve of the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. Almost 25 centuries ago. It's the largest Jewish community in the world. And it's not just a question of numbers. What's been accomplished over the years, over the decades, if I don't move you to stand up and clap when I say the next sentence, or to jump and do cartwheels of joy, something is wrong with me, not with you. I came across the other day something that's called the National Power Index. It's put out by a think tank in India every year, and they evaluate each country in the world in terms of how powerful they are, with a number of different indicators, militarily, economically, technologically, etc. About over 200 member states of the United Nations, where do you think Israel ranks in the most powerful nation status, the National Power Index? Take a guess. Three. That's optimistic. Ten is perfect. Tenth. Now, to give you an idea of who our competitors are as we try to move up the rankings, so of course, the United States, the most powerful country in the world still. Hope it remains, but it's up in the air. Second is China. Russia. France is fourth. Japan is fifth. The UK, Britain is sixth. Germany is seventh. India is eighth. Canada is ninth. And Israel is tenth. More than Brazil. More than Italy. More than take almost any other country in Asia, all right? Why is it 10th? Because in military capability, it ranks 6th. In technological capability, it ranks 4th. And the way it elevates the lives of its citizens, it ranks very, very highly. To give you an estimate, just an assessment of what it means to be 10th, Israel has a geographical a territory of a little over 22,000 square kilometers. That's Israel's territory, including all of Judea and Samaria. 22,000 square kilometers. That's 10 times smaller than the next smallest country, which is Britain, which has a territory of about 230,000 square kilometers. It's small. In terms of population, its population of 8 million, it's less than four times that of Canada, which is the country right above it with the other smallest population. So it's tiny in size, it's tiny in population, and yet it has this power, National Power Index. How's it possible? I don't know. I have a guess. Birkas Hashem. It's God's blessing to the world, but especially to our generation. We're living through the fulfillment of biblical prophecies. Every week in shul, you come, you read the Haftarah. Haftarah always ends with words of comfort. Even the recent Haftarahs. We read a few weeks ago, Ezekiel's prophecy of the dry bones. His vision of the dry bones. It's not an exaggeration. It's the daily newspaper. It's the headlines. The dry bones came back to life. And it assumed a very muscular form. Sinews, bones, blood vessels, strength, might. Not only do we walk the earth, we walk the earth proudly, with pep in our step, with something to contribute to the rest of the world. Torah, the prophets predicted time and again that after a long exile, the Jewish people would return to our homeland, to the land of Israel. It starts with the Torah. Vishav Hashem Elokecha, Eshivus Chavricha Mecha. That God will restore, have mercy on us, and restore our captivity. Vishav Kibetzcha Mikol Ha'amim Asher Hefitzcha Hashem Elokecha Shama. And God will gather us in from all the countries to which he has scattered us across the four corners of the earth. Even if you're scattered to the wide expanses of the earth, from there God will gather you. From there he'll bring you back. We've all heard of this great prophecy, Kibbutz Golios, the ingathering of the exiles. We wonder, when is it going to happen? It happened. It's happening before our eyes. Israel hosts Jews from over 170 countries now across the world, speaking over 110 different languages. That's why they always talk past each other. 110 different languages. The prophets prophesied of the ingathering of the exiles. It's happened right before our eyes. So, you know, the sages tell us, Ein Baal Nes Makir Biniso. The person who's living through the miracle doesn't see it, because to us it's normal. But the fact is, it's not normal. It's never happened in history. It's unprecedented. No other country, no other people had such a destiny. No other people had such a vision that ultimately they would return to their homeland and establish a state there under God's rule. We have it. We had it. We're doing it. We did it. It's before our eyes. At least we should be appreciative of it. We say in the bracha of Kriyat Shema every morning that God Ravienu me'arba kanfos haaretz. He should bring us from the four corners of the earth. Yes. Granted, American Jews are lagging behind. I mentioned before that you have very few Jews living today under despotic regimes. Almost all of those Jews have gone to Israel. Some elsewhere, most are in Israel now. But now Israel awaits the aliyah, the ascension of the Jews from the free countries, which happens slowly also over time. You know, just to give you an interesting insight that I saw the other day, last year, in a year from last Independence Day to this one, 178,000 new babies were born in Israel, 42,000 people died, 24,000 olim, new immigrants, came to Israel. So, God forbid, there's always a death rate. Of the death rate, almost more than half, almost 60% of the death rate is compensated for by new immigrants. And then you have over 175,000 new children born in Israel every year. We'll get back to that in a moment. But you see a thriving land. You see Jews returning. Our turn will come as well. But nonetheless, it's something different. It's something remarkable. We see in our day fulfilled one of the mitzvos, one of the commandments of the Torah, the Ramban, Nachmanides understood it in the 13th century. The mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, settling the land of Israel. We should leave no part of the land of Israel in the hands of any alien. The mitzvah, the commandment is that it should be completely under Jewish sovereignty. All right, we had it for a time. We've squandered some of it. But nonetheless, in our generation, we see the return and the flourishing and the prospering of the Jewish people in the land of Israel, in that particular mitzvah as well. The prosperity that exists, if you want to be 10th on the National Power Index, and of course we aspire for more as well, not to insult our Canadian neighbors to the north. The technology, Israel is a technological marvel. Comes from many who served in the military, got special training, but just comes from, what can I say, Jewish brains. We have a cup. We use our cup. We're always thinking, you know, out of the box for new things. I was at the APEC conference 2 months ago, and they brought in some of Israel's current technological whizzes with their new products, and I was astounded to see it. One company in Israel created a camera that sees through walls. A camera that sees through walls. Brick, stone, doesn't matter. And it's sold now across the world. They had there a sergeant from the state of Georgia, sheriff from the state of Georgia, who uses it in hostage situations. You just camera from here, you can see through that wall everything in the room. You see the shapes walking around. So they know when they want to burst into a room to save a hostage, they know everybody's sitting. They know who to shoot, who not to shoot, who's stationary, who's mobile. It's an amazing thing. They developed it. They developed technology, and Israel's the world leader today in irrigation and water preservation. Technology, computer program, that they could monitor. Countries across the world are buying this. They can monitor waste of water. For example, countries that struggle for water, if there's a leak in a water pipe, it could be weeks before they know about it. Now it's instantaneous. It's all monitored by computer. They know. They had, in fact, in real time. One of the jurisdictions they do this for is in Melbourne, Australia. And he's able to show on the computer, on the screen, yeah, they have a leak at this street right here, right now, and they'll call them, let them know. It's like, you know, it's another day there, but it's all coming from Israel. It's all coming from Jewish ingenuity, a startup nation, as you've heard. Pioneers that we are in so many different fields. That's a new world. For years, for centuries, the Jewish people were perceived as downtrodden, with very little to offer the rest of the world, barely clinging to life. For a time, our population dwindled into the hundreds of thousands. And now look where we are today, thank God. And of course, just in terms of the economy looking forward, you see the tremendous discoveries of the last 2 years. Israel, you know, everyone always wondered why God took the Jews wandering 40 years in the desert. took the only place in the Middle East without oil. You know, it's an old joke. Off the coast of Israel now, in the northern Mediterranean, they found these natural gas fields, trillions of cubic feet of natural gas. The Tamar field, the Leviathan, the Leviathan field. Within 4 years, Israel will be an energy exporter. Think about what that means. Think about, you know, the oil embargo, the Yom Kippur War. Israel, within 4 years, will be an energy exporter to countries that want to buy from it. What a sea change in what's happening, and all that's ahead of us. Is there poverty in Israel? Yes. But I say, quite honestly, poverty exists essentially among those who don't work, which, by the way, has a certain logic to it. If you don't work, you will be poor. But in the general society, yeah, the standard is not as high as it is in the U.S. It's higher than Italy. It's approaching France. You don't work, you don't earn. It's a problem. But of those who do, it's an extremely high and favorable standard of living. Well, are there problems in Israel? Well, there have to be some problems. But I hear there's good news about that also. There's good news about the problems. First of all, ensures you don't become complacent. Well, there's something to complain about, and always have something to improve. But I tell you something else, which I think is even more important. Each of the problems that Israel has is over a century old. There's nothing new. Nothing has changed. And I'll just quickly take you one by one through the various problems that exist, and you'll see that nothing has really changed. Take, for example, the religious secular tensions in Israel that crop up every now and then in the newspapers now. The Haredim will serve, won't serve, will work, won't work. The government will subsidize study of Torah and Yeshiva, won't subsidize it. The question is, question always was, what is the Jewish state to be? An ethnic state, a religious state, both, and the various viewpoints. I tell you right here and now, all those viewpoints and all the parties who are feuding today over these issues, they were all already in existence in 1902. As a matter of fact, in 112 years, hasn't been one new idea out of any of them, except for one, and that is that the secular part of the Zionist movement, for the most part, has abandoned socialism. But they're still secular. They abandoned socialism. Why do they abandon socialism?
It doesn't work.
Well, it doesn't work. Well, it's like Margaret Thatcher said, the only problem with socialism is that eventually you run out of other people's money. And that's what happened, and so even the kibbutzim became more capitalist. There's a secular party. There's a religious Zionist party that sees the state of Israel as the integration of Torah and civilization and culture and the natural fulfillment of the biblical prophecies as I have spelled out. And there's another religious party. Then it was the old Yishuv. Today they're called the Haredim, the old community of Jerusalem, those who basically lived off the charity from the outside. They weren't really into developing the economy or the national framework of the state. The old Yishuv, today the Haredim, it's the exact same groups. And in many cases, the descendants of the original disputants are the same people arguing today really over the same thing. Each group just has a different conception of what a Jewish state is to be. So the fight that you read about today in the newspapers is essentially the same fight that started in 1902. In fact, was very pronounced in the 19-teens and the 30s and then the 40s. And there was a certain rapprochement that went into effect in 1948-49. And now, it's all right, 65 years later, they want to revisit it, which is fine. Society's also changed. But it's the same thing. There's nothing new. And we'll all fight. That's part of our way, part of the Jewish charm. We fight amongst ourselves, but we'll find some way to work it out, or, as we often do, just kick the can down the road for the next generation to deal with. What else? The Israeli-Arab dispute. You've heard about that, right? It's in the papers. Disproportionately so. You know, the world's obsessed with Israel for reasons which really are inexplicable. So here's the good news. So that dispute is also entering a healthy second century already. There's nothing new about that. For decades, the truth is, for most of the century, It was an existential war. Israel's various enemies wanted to destroy it. Today it's more of a civil war, so to speak, because the Arabs living in Israel have become proxies, in one sense, the only active enemy that Israel has. There's so much else happening in the Middle East today. All of Israel's natural enemies, those who waged war against it consistently, 48, 56, 67, 73, except for Jordan. The same enemies are having their own tsaras today. Egypt's in turmoil, and now Egypt sees Israel as a natural ally against the Muslim Brotherhood. Syria, so we all know that sad situation. They're killing each other by the hundreds of thousands, and Israel has no position, rightfully so. Jordan has made has a peace treaty, but forget the paper, it has a symmetry of interests with Israel as well. Also to try to deflect the Muslim Brotherhood, radical Islam, and to be, with Israel, they're pro-American, or at least in America's orbit, more than part of the third world. One of the most interesting, Iraq has been neutralized for the most part. One of the most interesting developments in the last year and a half, has been the growing cooperation in private between Israel and the Saudis, who are really the most implacable of Israel's Islamic enemies because they're Wahhabis. They don't get along with anyone else in Islam, much less with Jews. I mean, of course, we know until today, a Jew is not allowed to set foot in Saudi Arabia. But nonetheless, they see a confluence, a convergence of interests with Israel against Iran. We'll get back to Iran in a little while, but who would have thought even 10 years ago, 20 years ago, that all of Israel's enemies that surrounded it and constantly wished to wage war against it and destroy it, for the most part, they're all neutralized. And Israel has to concentrate on its domestic foe, which, although dangerous, is not really an existential threat. One premise is still true. And we say this openly, I don't want to offend anybody, but this is the reality as I see it. One premise has always existed. Muslims are intolerant of any non-Muslim presence in the Middle East. Always have been, and frankly, always will be. And the more they're radicalized, the more it will remain like that. They'll mute it for a time because of other interests. But they see the Jews as the primary enemy, but they don't treat the Kurds or the Copts in Egypt any better. They're not Muslims. And we occupy what to them is a waqf, a sacred territory that's really Muslim. You know, they have grandiose ambitions. There's a movement now in the Islamic world to take back Al-Andalus. What's Al-Andalus?
Spain,
exactly. Because once a Muslim controls territory, it's theirs. Oh, so they were expelled from Spain in January 1492, okay, now they want to come back and take it over. It's also waqf to them. So they have a lot of things on their plate, but the bottom line is the tensions will always be there, but the dangers are much less than they ever were, and Israel is much more powerful than it ever was. Egypt is no longer a threat in the short term. Syria is not a threat. There is a threat in Lebanon because of Iran through Hezbollah. But nonetheless, that also is a threat that Israel is dealing with in a number of ways. Well, what's happened? So nothing's really new. Nothing's changed. Yeah, the names of the presidents and the secretaries of state that try to resolve this intractable problem, those do change, but the problems don't change. The problems still exist, but the problems are very manageable. As long as we're able to move beyond the clichés that really weigh us down. And I think one of the things that we've suffered from now for several decades already is that we become accustomed to cliches and to double standards that substitute for real thinking or creative thinking. I'll give you a few examples. Who knows the origin of the phrase, the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by force? Okay, I don't mean to stump you. That's from Resolution 242. That the UN adopted in 1967, October 67, after the Six-Day War. It's inadmissible unlawful, illegal for a nation to acquire territory by force. It sounds so idealistic. It sounds so wonderful to live in such a world. There's only one problem with it. Every country that exists on earth has acquired its territory by force, all right? But apparently the only country in the world to which that very lofty principle will ever be applied is the state of Israel. Go tell Putin that it's inadmissible to acquire territory by force. But it's a cliche, and one would think that it's really part of international law. No, it's actually fabricated to be a truncheon with which to hit the Jews over the head with. It doesn't exist. There's another cliche that we suffer from now over 45 years. Land for peace. Who ever heard of such a concept? Where in the world have we ever seen such a concept applied to a resolution of a dispute between nations? Or said a different way, where have we ever found in the history of mankind, from the moment Adam walked the earth, that an aggressor has the right to attack another nation, and then if the aggressor is defeated, he says, okay, just give me back my land, and we'll let bygones be bygones. Where has that ever happened? By the way, there's a precedent for it. It's in the Haftarah for Parshas Chukas. It's in the book of Shoftim, the book of Judges. I think I have a chapter on this, or part of it in one of my books, where the Israelis, they call themselves the Israelites, but it's our ancestors. They captured part of Ammon. What's Ammon? Rabbat Ammon is Ammon. The capital still exists. Transjordan. And the king of Ammon said, okay, I'll tell you what. Ammon attacked. We defeated them, took his land. And he said these words, Hashiva eshem bishalom. Return us the land that you took from us after defending yourselves, and there'll be peace. That's the very first instance of land for peace. Okay? Who's the great judge in that story? Yiftach HaGiladi. Yiftach. And Yiftach said to the king of Ammon, the biblical equivalent of go fly a kite, that you attack us and we win and you want us to give you the land back. What world are you from? What, are you part of the United Nations? Whoever thought of such a thing? And he gave the next five or six verses discuss exactly why such a notion is preposterous, with the addendum that, hey, king of Ammon, this is the land that God promised our fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is the land that we promised when we went through Egypt and left and received the Torah at Sinai, and now we're here to reclaim it because it's our land. And then he fought for it. Land for peace. I mean, think about it. It just encourages more aggression. If I attack your house and take over your garage, right, and your dining room, and I say to you, okay, I'm sorry, we have to do it the reverse. If you attack me, right, and then I seize your house, or half your house, and you say, okay, give me back my house and we'll be even. But why? You attack me. The worst thing, the most illogical thing, the immoral thing, is to return to the aggressor the bases of his aggression. Because then there's no downside to aggression. There's nothing to lose. You attack, if you win, great. If you lose, okay, give it back. We're back to square one. That's not normal. But such a concept is applied in the world. But it's only applied to Israel. It's not applied to anyone else. It's another cliche that we also, in the last 15 years, have grown accustomed to. Two-state solution. Two states for two people. I tell you, it won't happen. It can't happen. Notwithstanding the fact that everyone seems to think that is the solution. If it would have happened, it would have happened already. In the 1970s, everyone across the board in the Jewish world, except for the far left, realized that to have a second Arab state within the territory of Israel would be an existential threat to the existence of the state of Israel. It still is. Nothing has changed. If anything, now we know it's even worse, because we know the nature of the people who want to establish that second state, which is not viable in any event. Israel cannot survive another partition, and not just because of security reasons. It would be unlivable. There would be constant terror. But I think for a broader reason, which was the most troubling aspect of Oslo, and that is it was the rejection of God's gifts. It was essentially adopting the narrative of the enemy and saying, okay, we understand where you're coming from. We have our story, you have your story. But the bottom line is, our story is real. Our story is rooted in the Bible. If we adopt their narrative as if somehow they have a nexus to the land that's substantive, that's legitimate, we undermine our own. Those who try to equate, I wrote this a year or two ago, those who try to equate the claim of the Jewish people to the land of Israel with the claim of the so-called Palestinian people to the land of Israel should answer one question. Name a Palestinian from the 19th century, or the 18th century, or the 17th, or the 16th, or the 15th, to the beginning of time. It was a people, so to speak, created in the 20th century. Before it, they didn't exist. They had no history. They have no culture, no independent language. They're indistinguishable from the other Arabs that existed.
They were brought in
that's correct.
By the Russian Jews.
Some of them, not all of them, some of them actually did come once the early Zionists came and they started to till the soil and make the land prosperous. And many Arabs come from the surrounding countries. And you know, their names give them away. There's a prominent family in Shechem, what they call Nablus. Itself is a corruption. Nablus is a corruption of Naples because the Romans named it that. But Shechem is a family called Al-Matsri, all right? Very famous, other mayors for a number of years, very wealthy family until today. What does the name tell you?
Egyptian.
They're Egyptian, Al-Matsri. Family came from Egypt for reasons of prosperity. They wanted to work and wanted to earn money, and they were successful. But don't say you're indigenous to the land. You're there even after the Jews came to the land. You're there at our sufferance. Don't say that you're there from time immemorial in the name of Joan Peters' famous book, because the fact is it's not so. So that was the catastrophe of Oslo in terms of the ideology, that we stopped believing in our own story and started adopting the story of someone else. But to believe in our story is to recognize what Jeremiah said, the song we all learned as children, "Vishavu vanim ligvulam." The time will come that the children return to their borders from the captivity in which they find themselves. That time came. So what are we going to say? God, thank you very much. We've returned to our borders. We've rebuilt our land. Now we'll just give it away for the sake of popularity in the world. That can't be. That makes no sense. And of course, there's one other cliche that I wrote about just last week that we should recognize because it's in the newspapers all the time, and that's the phrase peace process. You understand that... the Prime Minister last week canceled, at least temporarily, the peace talks with the Palestinians, all right? But as someone else said, the peace process, though, that goes on. How can it go on? So I'll tell you a story. It happened to me. I was there. I was a long-time opponent of Oslo from the very beginning, but I would be called to different meetings. I was down once at the Israeli consulate, and I'll tell you a name. I don't care. It was a Gad Ben-Ari. He was the press attaché, the communication director of Yitzhak Rabin, the prime minister. And I said to him, I asked him this question, because already I was skeptical from the very beginning and opposed on ideological grounds also. But I said to him, 1994, short of Yasser Arafat himself planting a bomb in the Knesset and being caught red-handed, what would cause you to end the peace process? And he said, it's a process. A process never ends. That's a cliche. But it's a deadly cliche. Because sometimes you have to say, you have to be honest, it's not going to happen. Not in this generation, not in the next generation. The enemy is too rigid. The enemy is too locked into what's now a religious, not just a nationalist ideology. But we're very, very, very well set up, well established to weather any storms ahead in the future. And they recognize that. That's why they engage in what the security apparatus calls low-level terror. You know, it's low-level except to the victims, stonings here and there, shootings here and there. And it should be met with a stronger hand, I concede. But I'll say that type of terror can be stopped, should be stopped, but it's not going to endanger Israel's existence at all. The clichés, though, all of them fostered the dangerous illusions of the 90s and the early 2000s and the mid-2000s, from which Israel is now just recovering, has a much healthier attitude going forward, a much more realistic attitude. What the Prime Minister really believes in his heart, don't ask me, nobody knows. Maybe his wife. No, certainly no one in his cabinet knows what he really believes. But nonetheless, for now the government is stable. I could promise you it will be stable at least until this Wednesday, because it's closed on Yom HaTzimut. Thereafter, who knows? But they have a direction. It's a very centrist government in the sense that it has different wings, different factions, and they're more or less united, more or less, not completely, on the way forward, and especially now to the halt. There's one other thing, and those are the genocidal threats that exist today. And of course, even that's not new. Think about it. 66 years ago, when the state was established, the very first remarks that emanated from the Arab world, they're going to throw the Jews into the sea. And that was the mantra in 48, and that was the mantra in 67. You may recall, as Azam Pasha, who was the Secretary General of the Arab League, he said in 1948, today, Hayyar, there's going to be a massacre of the Jews that will rival the massacres of the Mongol hordes in the first millennium. Those were genocidalists. They wanted to exterminate the Jewish people. Gamal Abdel Nasser was the same way. The war in 67 was to be a war of genocide. It's the exact same thing. And today it's Iran. And Iran is a big problem because their weapons capability has increased so dramatically. And there's an additional problem. And in the past, Israel was able to rely more or less on itself and take care of itself. And it had help from the U.S., and now, as we sense, relying on the Americans is not as secure as it was once. Nevertheless, I've heard from people in high places that indeed Israel has the military capacity to deal with Iran. The fear, though, is does it have the diplomatic capacity to weather the inevitable storms that will arise if indeed they seek to degrade the Iranian nuclear weapons program. And that's a big if. That's a tremendous if. I mentioned I was on Capitol Hill the other day, and many congressmen and senators, they believe Israel will have to take care of itself. Congress, by and large, both Democrats and Republicans, are very supportive of Israel if it has to take military action. I think there's a bill pending, or maybe pending, it was voted on even, that calls for U.S. support for Israel if it takes military action against Iran. But I could tell you that from the people that I met on Capitol Hill, no one really trusts the administration to support Israel if in fact it happens. And that now becomes something that's holding Israel back, but they'll have to deal with it. I don't think nobody on Capitol Hill believes that Iran is going to stop its program. No one believes that the president has the will or the interest in having Iran stop its program. That's a problem down the road. But Israel will be able to deal with it. Yes, sir?
There is a miracle in the making.
Yes?
I don't know if you read the DEPCA file today.
I did not.
Number two, Iranian has been speaking at the synagogue in Shiraz.
Okay, what did he say?
And he recognized what Cyrus did to recuperating the land of Judea against all the documents that have been coming all over, and now Iran, to be good with the West and to help the nuclear issue, they sent the number two man in Iran.
Okay.
Talking.
I don't know.
Synagogue.
Right. I don't know if I would rely on that.
I don't rely. Okay. On that. I don't trust them.
Right. Right. People just come to synagogues and speak, never make a difference, except for me, I hope. But in Iran, who knows? But by the way, you should know that the way Obama's treating Israel, I mean, someone wrote this the other day, I think it was the Council of Foreign Relations, that America in the last 5 years adopted a policy of basically pandering to adversaries, whether China, Russia, Iran, and being very harsh to allies, whether Israel, the UK, or Poland, or the Czechs, or the Saudis, etc. It's just part of a pattern of foreign policy. But it'll be dealt with. Baruch Hashem, thank God we're strong. We have the capability. And I think if it really came to it, you remember 1981, Begin made a very fateful decision to bomb the Osirak reactor in Iraq, outside of Baghdad, and it wasn't easy. I gave a lecture on this a few weeks ago. It was a very difficult, difficult decision. But he did it because he saw the dangers, and he was a different generation, of course. And the question is, will Netanyahu have that same drive, that same fearlessness, the same fortitude? I think he will, but all that remains to be seen. For the last year, Israel's undertaken a number of other measures, or others have, can't say for sure. Iranian scientists die of natural causes. Bullets happen to go through them, stray bullets, and the technology of their weapons programs develops viruses out of nowhere. Strange things happen. Who knows? So we look forward. We look forward to the future. But I'll tell you something else, which to all of us should be the most encouraging thing of all. For years, since the 70s really, one thing that we've heard again and again is that Israel has to make concessions and surrender and concede territory, certainly try to excise its Arab population because of the threat of demography, that eventually Israel will be overrun by hordes of Arabs and just the Jewish state will be voted out of existence. So here's the good news. And not many people know this, but you should. The demographic demon has been slaughtered in the last 5 years. And for the foreseeable future, it's not coming back. In the last half decade, the Arab birth rate across the Middle East has collapsed. But talk about within the land of Israel itself. The Palestinian birth rate has dropped. There's 2013 numbers. Replacement level is 2.1 children per family. The Palestinians now are at 2.7 per family. Not Israeli average. It's the same as Israel. 2.7 per family. More than half of what it was in 2007. What happened? Because they're living around Israel, around the modern state. Women are going to school like they can't in the Muslim world. Women are getting jobs. Women are not getting married at age 14, as you find elsewhere. They're waiting till later in life. They're having fewer children. The Saudi birth rate has dropped. Turkey now, for example, is around replacement rate. Europe, is below replacement level. What about in Israel? In Israel, besides Aliyah, besides the birth rate, I mentioned the raw numbers. Israel now averages, 2013 numbers, Palestinians are 2.7, 3.4 children per secular family. Wow. Secular family, 3.4 children. In the Dati Lumi, the religious Zionist community, 5 per family. In the settler community, 6 per family. And the Haredim, 7 per family, and that's a drop from 9 per family, and it was in the mid-2000s. Jewish women, thank God, are flourishing, all right? I'm not telling you what to do tonight, but I'm just saying, because by the way, the American Jewish birth rate is about 1.25 children per family, below, well below replacement level. So I was listening last week to a lecture by Professor Guy Bechor. If you want to listen to something interesting or read something interesting, go to, there's a famous demographer in Israel, former diplomat, Yoram Edinger. You've heard of him? Google Yoram Edinger, you'll see all the data. But I heard a lecture last week by Professor Guy Bechor, went through all the statistics, and he said such an interesting thing, which affects us also in a sense. Why are Israelis having so many children? All right. California, by the way, they're at net negative growth. They're about 1.2, 1.3. Why? So they did polls in California, and they said that women are looking for self-fulfillment. So they're going to work. They're having careers. They're not into family. They asked the same question in Israel. Why are Jewish women so prolific? Why are you having so many children? And the answer was self-fulfillment. Mimush atzmi. The Jewish woman to have a child, that's fulfilling. That grows the country. That makes it better for everyone. That idea that the demographic demon no longer exists should be changing the diplomacy and the statecraft that's saying that if Israel does not abandon Judea Samaria, then they're going to overrun us. It's not true. That's why Carolyn Glick, famous columnist, she's speaking next Sunday night in my shul, she wrote a book called The Israeli Solution, saying, let them all become citizens, because there's not enough of them. They're declining in population as we're growing. Israel's now, even if you count all the Arabs from the river to the sea, about two-thirds are Jews and one-third are non-Jews. That's not going to change. So I don't know if I agree with everything she says, but nonetheless, we're in a good position now. And we're in a good position for the foreseeable future. We have a young population, a fertile population, a population that wants to settle and develop the land. Once we exorcise from ourselves all the demons of the past and all the fears that have encumbered Jewish life for so many generations, and just see the positive road that's ahead of us. It's a beautiful medrash, and I'll close with this in Vayikra. It's a pasuk, a verse that we'll read on Shavuos in the Haftorah from the prophet Chavakuk. We don't encounter him that much, Chavakuk. But the pasuk says, Omad vayamoded eretz, that God stood and measured the earth. So the sages say, Modad HaKadosh Baruch Hu kol haaretzos, that God measured every land across the world, Velo matza eretz shereuya linasein liYisrael, ela eretz Yisrael. God did not find a land that's more fitting, more appropriate for the people of Israel than the land of Israel. It's a natural fit. Jewish history is long, it's glorious, it's occasionally very painful, but I tell you, the final chapter is being written now. Everything is in place. We just have to move our destiny forward. As the song says, Anachnu maminim bnei maminim. We are believers, the children of believers. Vein lano al mili shoein, ela al avinu shevashamayim. We have no one on whom to rely but our Father in heaven. Everything is b'yad Hashem. Everything is in God's hands. It's all His plan, but we see His plan unfolding before our eyes. We have our role to play, and the land awaits us, just as we all await the coming of the Messiah. I thank you all very much. That's up to you, whatever you want.
Wow.